content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We're reading this week from the July 27th, 2018 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week has, it's kind of a purple background, and there's a pair of those Russian nesting dolls that you take the top off and there's another one inside. There's a hand coming into the scene that's lifting off the big top, and the top looks like Donald Trump. And then the doll just inside that one actually looks like Vladimir Putin. So the title says, The Big Reveal. Why did a submissive Trump side with Putin against the U.S.? And that, in fact, is our main story. So we'll start with that. The blowback from Trump's summit with Putin. What happened? President Trump faced bipartisan condemnation this week for his warm embrace of Russian President Vladimir Putin at their summit meeting in Helsinki, during which he sided with the Kremlin in denying that it meddled in the 2016 presidential election. Asked about Russian hacking during the election at his joint press conference with Putin, Trump said, "I will say this, I don't see any reason why it would be Russia," adding, "President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today." Trump's own aides were reportedly flabbergasted by his direct contradiction of U.S. intelligence findings after they'd prepared him to press Putin on a range of issues, including election interference. Instead, Trump blamed, quote, "both countries for deteriorating U.S.-Russian relations," saying Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation had offended Russia and is a disaster for our country. The blowback was immediate and intense, with even staunch allies like former House Speaker Newt Gingrich calling Trump's comment the biggest mistake of his presidency. Trump grudgingly attempted to walk back his most inflammatory statements ahead of a meeting with congressional Republicans the next day, contending that he simply misspoke. The sentence should have been, "I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be Russia." Reading from a script, Trump also said that he accepts the intelligence community's conclusion that Russia interfered in the 2016 election, but ad-libbed, "could be other people too." Republican congressional leaders raced to contain the political fallout from Trump's remarks. House Speaker Paul Ryan and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell both held press conferences to reiterate that they believed the Kremlin interfered in the election. Congressional Democrats, meanwhile, demanded concrete actions to restrain and rebuke Trump, including a formal censure. Former CIA Director John Brennan called Trump's behavior, quote, "nothing short of treasonous," what the editorial said. President Trump's half-hearted efforts at damage control are too little too late, said the Washington Post. Nothing can change the fact that the president stood beside the leader of a hostile power and refused to condemn a blatant attack on American democracy. Nor did Trump rebuke Putin for any of his regime's other manifold crimes, including invading Georgia and Crimea, assassinating dissidents on foreign soil, and downing a civilian airliner over Ukraine. The only question now is whether Congress will move beyond tut-tutting and toward action that begins to restrain Trump. What happened to Trump's alpha dog attitude, asked the Washington Examiner. His supporters loved the way he steamrolled Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton while campaigning for president, and expected he'd take the same approach to international relations. But faced with a real strong man, Trump turned into a lapdog for one of America's most implacable foes, embarrassing himself and his country. His liberal critics assume Trump is being blackmailed by Russia, said NationalReview.com, but there's a simpler explanation for his refusal to state the obvious. In Trump's mind, admitting that the Russians worked to help him win delegitimizes his election victory. He can't bear the blow to his ego, what the columnist said. Trump has made his loyalties clear, said Lily Loofborough in Slate.com, and they are not to the country he governs. The president actively took the Kremlin's side against the U.S. interests. Dan Coats, Trump's own director of national intelligence, has confirmed not only that Russia interfered in the 2016 election, but also that Russian-backed hackers are actively targeting critical facilities in the U.S. nuclear, water, aviation, and manufacturing sectors, and will seek to hack the 2018 elections. But Trump cares only for his naked self-interest, and he thinks Putin is on his side. All the more reason for us to see Trump's tax return, said Timothy O'Brien in Bloomberg.com. In the decade before Trump became president, he had multiple business dealings with Russians and went on a $400 million spending spree on golf courses and new properties. Where did that money come from? His sons have said the company was getting most of its cash from Russia. Imagine if Trump were acquiescent to Putin because financial favors were exchanged. Americans had the right to know. Get a grip, said Danielle Pletka in TheAtlantic.com. Trump's performance in Helsinki was dreadful, even disgraceful, but it wasn't treason. Despite Trump's ill-considered personal admiration for Putin, his administration has been tough on Russia. The White House signed off on increased sanctions for Russia, sold arms to the Ukrainians, and even clashed with Russian troops in Syria. Look at what Trump does, not what he says. I'm deeply skeptical of the left's theory that Putin is blackmailing Trump with financial or personal kompromat, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. It's more likely he defers to Putin because of his intense affinity for strongmen, like China's Xi Jinping and Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan. It's also possible Trump knows his campaign did exchange information with the Russians. But even I have to admit that his obsequious attitude toward Putin was so bizarre that it's making the darkest theories look more likely. After Helsinki, everyone should hedge their bets. Our controversy of the week is titled Trump and NATO. Is the Western Alliance doomed? Now we know what America First really means, said Brett Stevens in the New York Times. In his excruciating trip to Europe last week, President Trump made it clear he intends to bring about the collapse of the liberal international order and such institutions as NATO, the G7, and the European Union. Trump's wrecking ball rampage began at the NATO summit in Brussels, where he berated our allies, Germany's Angela Merkel in particular, and threatened that the U.S. might go our own way if member states don't immediately meet their agreed-upon 2024 target for spending 2% of their GDP on their militaries, and soon double that spending to 4%. Next, in Britain, came the gratuitous humiliation of Prime Minister Theresa May. In an interview, Trump not only mocked May's weak handling of the delicate Brexit negotiations, but also essentially endorsed her rival Boris Johnson on the Trumpian grounds that Johnson obviously likes me and says very good things about me. Trump's disdainful treatment of our European allies was childish and dangerous, said Claire Berlinski in Politico.com. America's post-war statesmen purposefully designed the Western Alliance to unite Europe under U.S. protection. promote free markets and democracy, and prevent great power conflicts. The result? 70 years of peace and growing prosperity. If Trump succeeds in wrecking our alliance, the world will soon be neither peaceful nor prosperous. Sometimes you need a wrecking ball, said Erwin Stelzer in WeeklyStandard.com, if the goal is clearing the way for new and better structures. NATO simply cannot fulfill its mission, the mutual defense of its members, if those members continue to be what President Obama called free riders, basking in U.S. protection while refusing to invest in their own defense. Wealthy Germany most egregiously spends only 1.22% of its GDP on defense, preferring to fund its generous welfare state, and now wants to renege on its commitment to raise that figure to 2%. NATO isn't a social club, said David French in NationalReview.com. It's a military alliance, and Trump is right to be angry about the deadbeats. Trump's hostility toward Europe goes far beyond its military spending, said Ezra Klein in Vox.com. When he looks across the Atlantic, he sees a scary vision of America's possible future, a continent governed by liberal elites, overrun by Muslim immigrants, being strangled by political correctness and international alliances. He sees figures like Merkel and May as champions of a doomed, fuzzy-headed, cosmopolitan vision that his entire political career is dedicated to destroying. This is not just another family quarrel, said Robert Kagan in the Washington Post, and things will not be okay. The Western Coalition was in trouble even before Trump took office. A massive flow of Middle Eastern and African refugees into Europe has fueled the rise of extreme right-wing parties throughout the continent. Authoritarian leaders have already seized power in Poland and Hungary. Nationalism has severed Britain from the EU, and the continent's remaining democratic leaders desperately need the strong support of the U.S. and its president. Instead, they get Trump, an aspiring autocrat himself, and his insults and humiliations. The battle to save democracy from authoritarianism is the existential struggle of our time, said Max Boot, also in the Washington Post. America, under Trump, is on the wrong side. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for reading the Kindle version after Danish researchers discovered that three medieval manuscripts in a library's rare books collection were coated with arsenic, perhaps as a preservative. The toxicity of arsenic does not diminish with time, researchers noted. It was a good week for grooming after the holder of the world record for longest fingernails finally had them clipped off and donated them to Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum. I have become a real celebrity, said Sridhar Shilal, 82, of Pune, India, who had been growing his nails since 1952. It was a good week for not pressing charges after a Virginia man playing pickup basketball in a gym called the police when he was knocked to the ground by what he felt was an illegal screen. A responding officer reminded the players to be civil. And it was a bad week for oral suction when a gang of would-be gasoline thieves in Australia tried to siphon the fuel out of a parked tourist bus and tapped the onboard sewage tank instead. Oh, my. Police said the thieves fled with a somewhat bitter taste in their mouth. It was a bad week for the male ego after fashion designer Diane von Furstenberg, 71, called Viagra the worst thing to happen to women in recent years. Until ED drugs came along, she said, there was a certain fairness in how age treated the sexes. And it was a bad week for selective editing. After a photo of President Trump's prepared damage control statement asserting his belief in Russian election interference showed he crossed out a line pledging to bring anyone involved in that meddling to justice. And before we move on, a boring but important item. Nonprofits can conceal donors. Under a new rule adopted by the Trump administration, the IRS will no longer require certain tax-exempt organizations, such as the NRA, AARP, and Planned Parenthood, to disclose the names of donors. The policy applies to nonprofits that don't typically receive tax-deductible contributions, such as labor unions, social clubs, chambers of commerce, and politically active groups. Republicans applauded the change, arguing that forced disclosure exposes contributors to harassment and intimidation. Democrats, however, say the decision will expand the influence of, quote, dark money in elections, including contributions by foreign nationals. The names weren't available to the public, but now even the IRS won't be able to trace the funding of these groups. The title of our briefing page article is Oceans of Plastic. What happens after an endless supply of plastic in consumer products winds up in the sea? How bad is the pollution? A garbage truck's worth of plastic enters the world's oceans every minute. All told, humanity has dumped up to 14 million tons of plastic pollution into the seas, and bits of it can be found from the water's surface down to its most extreme depths. You wouldn't know it looking over the side of a ship, since much of the waste has been broken down by waves and ultraviolet light into microplastics, particles often as small as a millimeter wide. But when researchers in 2015 analyzed more than a million pieces of trash in the Pacific, 99.9% of it was plastic. Scientists have no idea how long that will take to degrade, perhaps hundreds of years, if ever. By 2050, according to the World Economic Forum, there will be more plastic by weight in the ocean than fish. Where is it coming from? Since plastic became incorporated into many consumer products in the 1950s, only about 21% has been recycled or incinerated. What makes plastic appealing, that it's not only cheap and versatile, but also virtually indestructible, makes it a nightmare to dispose of. And about 3% of plastic produced in coastal countries eventually enters the ocean. Fishing nets and other plastic fishing gear are a major source. So is lightweight plastic litter, which can be blown off garbage trucks, barges, and landfills, or deliberately dumped into rivers or sewer systems and carried out to sea. Most of the worst polluters are developing countries with rudimentary waste management systems. China bears the greatest responsibility, accounting for about 30% of the global total, while the United States ranks 20th. A less obvious form of plastic pollution comes from microparticles found in products such as deodorant, toothpaste, and sunscreen that wash down drains. Many clothes are made with synthetic fibers, and one wash cycle can cause 200,000 fibers to escape into wastewater. As a consequence, the Hudson River in New York, for example, dumps about 150 million plastic fibers into the ocean every day. Where does it all go? A lot of it winds up in five huge masses of plastic debris called gyres, created by currents in the world's ocean. The largest of these swirling plastic stews is the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, formed by winds and currents between California and Hawaii. It's twice the size of Texas and increasing exponentially, according to a study published earlier this year. A plastic patch along the North Atlantic between Virginia and Cuba is nearly as large. These five gyres cover as much as 40% of the planet's ocean surface. To clean up all five would take 1,000 boats filtering the water 24 hours a day for 79 years. Is it affecting marine life? Yes, though the impact is not well understood. The Convention on Biological Diversity counts 663 species affected by plastic pollution in the ocean. Researchers find that fish raised in waters with heavy concentrations of microplastics are smaller, slower, and more stupid than normal fish. For some sea creatures, the impact is more obvious and immediate. In June, after a struggling whale died in the Thai Canal, its stomach was found to contain 17 pounds of plastic, including 80 shopping bags, which had prevented the whale from digesting food. Fish, mammals, and birds dead from a similar cause are washing up on beaches around the world. Are humans at risk? The evidence is unclear. The polymers in plastics are chemically inert, but some common additives in plastic behave similarly to human hormones and might do damage in high concentrations. And it's becoming increasingly difficult not to ingest plastics. A study last year found 83% of the world's drinking water is contaminated, while this year researchers found 93% of bottled water contains some plastic, often double the amount found in tap water. Seafood also often contains plastic. I think we'll find all sorts of unintended consequences, said Ronald Geyer, an industrial ecologist at the University of California, Santa Barbara. I'd be very surprised to find out that it is a purely aesthetic problem. What's being done? There are growing efforts here and abroad to use less plastic, such as the hashtag Stop Sucking campaign to get rid of disposable plastic straws, and municipal laws banning plastic bags. Unfortunately, the environmental net gain of such efforts is small, and scientists agree that effective remedies to plastic pollution will require global cooperation. The European Union launched a plastic strategy this year that aims to make all plastic packaging recyclable by 2030. But at the G7 summit in June, the U.S. and Japan refused to support a declaration on climate change that included targets on curbing plastic pollution, fearing its impact on their economies. Reversing the damage, purging the ocean of plastic, sounds like an all but impossible task, given that there are trillions of nanoparticles dispersed in the water, yet there's no shortage of proposals to do just that. A 23-year-old Dutch environmentalist named Boyan Slat has raised more than $30 million for a project called the Ocean Cleanup, which will deploy long floating barriers that he says can trap and remove half of the plastic in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch within 5 years. Scientists, however, fear the effect of Slat's design on sea animals and zooplankton living close to the surface. Researchers in Europe have discovered that the greater wax moth produces larvae capable of degrading polyethylene, which makes up 40% of the plastics. If that enzyme were harvested, it could be produced on an industrial scale to break down plastics in landfills and the ocean. Others have proposed sucking up ocean plastics with marine drones, waterborne kites, or artificial underwater drains, though these ideas have met with plenty of skepticism. In the meantime, people can chip away at pollution the old-fashioned way. Every year on Coastal Cleanup Day, hundreds of thousands of volunteers in more than 100 countries pick up about 20 million pounds of trash on shorelines, much of it plastic. Time for a few of the best columns of the week. We'll take two from the U.S. to start. The first titled, Triggering Racial Resentment. In the Trump era, identity politics benefits the right more than the left, said Sherry Berman. The left assumes that people who support President Trump are motivated by simple racism. But the cultural and status fears and resentments he taps are complex. Social scientists who've studied the Trump phenomenon say his stress on, quote, growing immigration, the power of minorities, and the rise of China, end quote, triggers a defensive reaction among Americans who feel the power and status of their own group has been waning. In everyday life, these people may not espouse racist beliefs or treat non-white people badly, but telling them over and over that they are under threat and are being pushed around by other groups makes them anxious and angry. As one psychologist put it, it's as if some people have a button on their foreheads, and when the button is pushed, they feel a need to defend their group. So when Democrats insist Trump supporters are racist who will be left behind in a multicultural U.S., that only makes Trump loyalist and Republican-leaning independents want to defend him even more. To defuse Trumpism, Democrats need to help citizens see what unites them instead of focusing on their differences. Don't rely on FEMA in disasters. FEMA has a novel suggestion for Americans as the 2018 disaster season heats up. Don't rely on us, said Emily Atkin. The Federal Emergency Management Agency was clearly overwhelmed by the three major hurricanes that devastated parts of the U.S. last year, as it admits in a new report. The FEMA report acknowledges that the agency vastly underestimated how much food, water, and other vital supplies it needed in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, as well as the logistical challenges in distributing that aid. To better cope with future disasters, FEMA says, state and local governments, businesses, and private citizens will have to make their own preparations and take responsibility for recovery. It's probably good advice, since FEMA paid for less than 10% of the $265 billion in damage caused by Hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria. Some people in Texas and Puerto Rico still are without homes. Although FEMA refuses to use the term climate change in its report, scientists say a warmer, wetter atmosphere is causing disasters to become more frequent and more damaging. Unless our society and our government comes to grips with that reality, FEMA will find itself overwhelmed indefinitely. This column comes from the United Kingdom. Shocked by Trump's break with decorum. Britain is still reeling from a wrecking visit by the ally from hell, said The Guardian in editorial. Prime Minister Theresa May piled on the pomp for U.S. President Donald Trump last week, hosting him at Blenheim Palace and the Chequers country home, country estate, and arranging tea at Windsor Castle with the Queen, all far away from the 250,000 protesters marching against him in London. Trump repaid this generosity by giving an explosive interview to the Rupert Murdoch-owned Sun tabloid, in which he ranted about how immigration was ruining the country and praised May's political rival, Boris Johnson, who had quit as her foreign minister just days earlier, as, quote, a very talented guy who would make a great prime minister. Worst of all, he declared that May's plan for a soft Brexit, in which Britain would stay close to the European Union after leaving the bloc by still following many of its regulations and customs rules, would kill any future UK-US trade deal. It was a stab in the back, And yet May brought it on herself by inviting Trump in the first place. This is a man hostile to our interests and values who wants to break up international institutions like NATO and the EU. Trump later pretended to walk back his criticism in a joint press conference with May by inanely declaring that the UK-US relationship was the highest level of special, said the Daily Mirror. In fact, Trump only sees Britain with the voracious eyes of an asset stripper, as a country ripe for exploitation once we have left the EU. Let's be clear about why Trump wants the UK to sever all ties with our European partner, said Kevin McGuire, also in the Daily Mirror. He knows that the mighty U.S. can bully an isolated post-Brexit Britain into accepting a one-sided trade deal that will slash our regulatory standards to American levels. Then, U.S. exporters will be free to send us their chlorinated chicken and gas-guzzling gargantuan SUVs, and American companies will help privatize our beloved National Health Service. But if we remain aligned with the EU after Brexit, we can negotiate a wider Europe-US trade agreement from a position of strength, and this rogue president won't be able to push us around. We can all agree that Trump displays appallingly bad manners, said Charles Moore in the Daily Telegraph. But good manners can be a way to conceal truth. And the simple truth is that May's Brexit plan would betray everything the British people voted for in the 2016 referendum. A clear majority voted to break free from the rule-bound EU and embrace a future in which the UK can strike deals with the US and other great trading nations. May might feel offended by Trump's undiplomatic criticism, but he's right when he says that her Brexit plan is not the deal that was in the referendum. Trump believes there is nothing wrong with a democratic country that wants to rule itself and put its own interests first. Does May? Our article for the last word this week takes us out of the political realm for a little while. The title is How the Pineapple Became So Popular. When Christopher Columbus brought the first pineapple to Europe, the spiky exotic fruit created a sensation, said writer Nina Sofia Morales. Soon, kings and aristocrats were co-opting king pine for their own purposes. There is no nobler fruit in the universe, Jean Delery writes of the pineapple. Charles Lamb loved the fruit erotically. Pleasure bordering on pain, from the fierceness and insanity of a relish, like a lover's kisses she biteth. Pieter de la Court professes, one can never be tired with looking on it. How did these men and so many others become so enraptured with the pineapple? And how have we forgotten its former grandeur? In 1496, when Christopher Columbus was returning from his second voyage to the Americas, he brought back a consignment of pineapples. Little did he know that this golden gift, nestled among the tame parrots, tomatoes, tobacco, and pumpkins, would be the crowning glory of his cargo. The fateful pineapple that reached Spanish King Ferdinand II of Aragon was the sole survivor. It was the only specimen that had not dissolved into a sticky rot during the journey. It produced enough of an impression for Peter Martyr, tutor to the Spanish princes, to record the first tasting. The most invincible King Ferdinand relates that he has eaten another fruit brought from those countries. It is like a pine nut in form and color, covered with scales, and firmer than a melon. Its flavor excels all other fruits. At least part of the excitement came from the fruit's spiked form, which sent Europeans into rapture. Ferdinand's envoy to Panama, Gonzalo Fernandez de Oviedo y Valdez, writes, "It is the most beautiful of any fruits I have seen. I do not suppose there is in the whole world any other of so exquisite and lovely appearance." The sweetness of the pineapple, too, should not go unmentioned. Renaissance Europe was a world essentially bereft of common sweets. Sugar refined from cane was an expensive commodity, and orchard-grown fruits were subject to seasons. The pineapple may well have been the tastiest thing anyone had ever eaten. But delicious or otherwise, it was still the preserve of adventurers, and the pineapple might never have made it into common lore if it hadn't coincided with yet another global development, the widespread dissemination of the written word. Though books had been in production since the mid-15th century, the 16th century saw an estimated increase of 130 million books flood Western Europe. Sailors and scholars alike took up the pen to chronicle tales from the New World, its civilizations, climate, flora, and fauna. Suddenly, wider knowledge of the pineapple led people to notice its glaring absence in the Bible and classical texts. As Fran Bowman notes in her book, The Pineapple, that it was previously unknown in the Old World meant that it was free of the cultural resonances that engulfed other fruits. While the pomegranate suffered under the legacy of Persephone and the apple was stained by the creation story, the pineapple was, Bowman continues, a completely blank page under which ruling powers could press their own meanings. It did not take long for the absolutist monarchy, still unshaken on the continent, to co-opt the pineapple for its own purposes. The French priest Father Duterte may have been the first to bless it, the king of fruits. But by the mid-17th century, this imperial image was exceedingly popular. The French physician Pierre Pommet's exalting explanation runs, It was thought a just appellation to call the ananas the king of fruits, because it is much the finest and best of all that are upon the face of the earth. It is for this reason that the King of Kings has placed a crown upon the head of it, which is an essential mark of its royalty. The pineapple became a symbolic manifestation of the divine right of kings. Not only did it suit royalist agendas to claim anything with a crown had been appointed by heaven, but the distaste the pineapple had to travel to get to Europe meant few people had seen or tried one. This added an extra mythical quality that could not be contested. The situation in England, however, was set to change. During the sparing Cromwellian years that followed the English Civil War of 1642, there are no mentions of the pineapple in print. To the staunchly Protestant Oliver Cromwell, the pineapple must have seemed like an insufferable luxury compared with, say, the humble pear. Bowman writes, "Besides, Cromwell was not willing to embrace a fruit whose leafy headgear was red as evidence of God's favor. In England, torn by issues of governance, the pineapple was briefly the enemy. Then Charles II was recalled to take the throne in 1660, and a new era of plenty was ushered in. Nicknamed the Merry Monarch, Charles II was celebrated for his voluble personality, swaggering court of cavaliers, and rapacious love of women. Cromwellian Puritanism was cast aside in favor of the revival, and splendor returned to the dining table with glistening meats, trembling jellies, and sugar sculptures. In the pineapple, which Charles II christened King Pine, he saw an opportunity. In 1668, when the French ambassador came to England to mediate a heated debate over the island of St. Kitts in the West Indies, Charles II ordered a pineapple from Barbados, then an English colony, to be perched at the top of a pyramid of fruit at dinner. It was a wily move to assert English ascendancy in the region and a public relations triumph. "We can get pineapples," it seemed to relay, "and you cannot." From then on, the pineapple became Charles II's favorite status symbol. He even had a painting commissioned of himself being presented a pineapple by the royal gardener, though this was another bit of clever PR. The pineapple still could not be grown in northern climates. As European kingdoms tussled for power in the colonies, and particularly as the Dutch gained ground, England's access to pineapples would continue to be leveraged as proof of its strength. Unluckily for the British, the Dutch were also keen and able gardeners. The first greenhouse was constructed in the Netherlands in 1682, intensifying the rivalry between the two nations. When the Dutch cloth merchant Pieter de la Court had a breakthrough in the process of growing pineapples, the English were galled into a jealous frenzy. This only subsided when a former English princess and her Dutch husband, ironically named William of Orange, took the throne. William's new title as King of England did much to calm the pineapple wars. By the Georgian era, pineapples could be raised on the British Isles. Cue countrywide madness. As the Enlightenment period made the rich richer, the landed aristocracy began to engage in a frenzy of new hobbies, including gambling, boozing, and time-consuming, expensive pineapple cultivation. Pineries needed care around the clock, custom-built greenhouses, and mountains of coal to keep the temperatures high. The fruit took 3 or 4 years to bloom. The cost of rearing each one was equivalent to $8,000 in today's money. The sheer expense meant it was considered wasteful to eat them, and they remained, as during Charles II's reign, dinnertime ornaments. Pineapple would be passed from party to party until it began to rot, and the maids who transported the pineapple placed themselves in mortal danger should they be accosted by thieves. For those who did not have the funds to grow their own, a bevy of pineapple rental shops sprang up. By the 1770s, it had entered the lexicon as a commendation. A pineapple of the finest flavor was a phrase used for anything that was the best of the best. For instance, "My birthday party was a pineapple of the finest flavor." In Sheridan's 1775 play, The Rivals, a character compliments another by pronouncing, "He is the very pineapple of politeness." During the expansion of trade in the 18th century Britain, home goods companies began to cash in on the pineapple as a status symbol. Wedgwood, makers of fine china, began to produce tableware with pineapple themes for the upper classes. Carved stone pineapples appeared on plinths outside grand manor houses, pronouncing to passers-by the largesse and high standing of the family within. They adorned carriages, topped garden temples, figured in countless paintings, and were turned into enormous sculptures gracing country gardens. Pineapples had become synonymous with good taste, nobility, and limitless wealth. It was a primarily English phenomenon. Pineapples disappeared from France after the 1789 revolution, and other countries such as Spain, Portugal, and even Russia, where a pineapple had once made it to the court of Catherine the Great, could not keep up with the UK's heavy investment in pineapple cultivation. As steamships began to import the fruit in greater quantities from the colonies, the pineapple's reputation deteriorated. Industrialization, war, and shortages served to push the fruit further from cultural consciousness. It seems strange now that this fruit, easily purchased in chunks at any supermarket, ever engendered such furor. Yet in the past few years, the world, or at least the world of those who shop at Urban Outfitters, has witnessed a return of the pineapple motif. Its bristly shape appears on clutch bags in the form of novelty shot glasses, stuck on cute stationery and phone cases. After the advent of cheap canned pineapple rings and the pineapple chunks atop Hawaiian pizzas, it seems difficult to believe that this most recent embrace of the pineapple's whimsical form has anything to do with status. Trends in hipster decorating motifs, from owls to pineapples and, more recently, cacti to flamingos, follow little discernible logic. The website Trend Bible pins the emergence of the pineapple as connected to the 2016 Summer Olympics in Brazil and a subsequent growing interest in South America. Though the king pine appeared on wallpaper and statement socks as early as 2014. Perhaps the memory of when people had never seen anything so spiky or tasted anything so sweet lingers in our collective subconscious. At the very least, the modern love of the pineapple feeds into people's constant yearning for summer, for faraway tropical lands. A life of heat and pleasure, a life of leisure, in fact, just like aristocrats once had. This was originally published in the Paris Review. We'll read a couple of the health and science articles this week. The first is titled, The Health Benefits of, quote, Forest Bathing. The Japanese practice of Shinrin-yoku, or forest bathing, using the senses to soak up the sights, smells, and sounds of the natural world, really does provide health benefits, new research suggests. Scientists at the University of East Anglia analyzed the findings of more than 140 studies involving nearly 300 million people from 20 different countries, including the U.S., Spain, Australia, and Japan. They found that spending more time outside in nature or living near green spaces, including urban parks, is associated with a lower risk for type 2 diabetes, heart disease, early death, and high blood pressure, as well as with better sleep and stronger feelings of well-being. Forest bathing is already really popular as a therapy in Japan, says the study's co-author, Kaohumi Tukoi-Bennett. Our studies show that perhaps they had the right idea. That might be partly because time spent in green spaces promotes physical activity, exposure to sunlight, and reduced pollution. Breathing in phytoncides, which are organized compounds emitted by trees, may stimulate our immune systems and reduce inflammation, says the study found concrete evidence that green space significantly reduces people's levels of salivary cortisol, a physiological marker of stress. Are multivitamins worthless? People who take multivitamins to protect their heart health are wasting their money, new research has found. A review of 18 studies involving 2 million people, followed for an average of roughly 12 years, found no scientific evidence that these products help prevent heart attacks, strokes, or death from heart disease, regardless of people's age, gender, and level of physical activity. These findings echo guidelines from the American Heart Association, which discourages the use of multivitamins for the prevention of heart disease. Nevertheless, dietary supplement sales are on the rise, and nearly 30% of Americans take multivitamins on a daily basis, assuming they'll be healthier for it. Some people even hope vitamins can make up for a poor diet or lack of exercise. I hope our study findings help decrease the hype around multivitamin and mineral supplements. The study's lead author, Dr. Joon-sik Kim, tells NBC News, "The researchers say you can promote heart health by eating a healthy diet rich in fresh fruits and vegetables, exercising regularly, and not smoking." And we'll just roll right over to the Talking Points page, starting with Hollywood, the battle over trans characters. What's more important, artistic freedom or social justice? That's the question at the heart of Scarlett Johansson's decision to withdraw from a role as a transgender man in an upcoming film, said Don Rose in ChicagoTribune.com. When news broke that Johansson would star in Rub and Tug as Dante Tex Gill, a larger-than-life trans man who ran a string of brothels in Pittsburgh, the trans community and its supporters erupted in outrage, demanding that a trans actor be given the part. Initially, Johansson defended herself, citing acclaimed performances by non-trans actors Jared Leto, Jeffrey Tambor, and Felicity Huffman in trans roles. Yet, under heavy pressure, Johansson apologized and backed out of the film. Trans actors certainly deserve more opportunities in Hollywood, but where does this precedent lead? Should only gay actors, for example, portray gays or lesbians? That's both a simple and complicated question, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com. It's taboo today for white actors to play black characters, and rightly so. But minstrel show spectacles were a form of racist mockery and disrespect. And that's not applicable here. Tracy Lissette, a trans actress, protested Johansson's casting on the grounds that it would take work from a trans actor. But it's hardly outrageous for a movie studio to prefer an international star like Johansson over an obscure transgender actor. The social justice warrior mob, however, was out for blood and even managed to pressure BusinessInsider.com into retracting an opinion column defending Johansson's casting. For all of its grievances, the trans community sure has a lot of cultural power. Nothing's more frustrating than the argument that box office success matters more than respecting someone's identity, said Samantha Allen in thedailybeast.com. How can trans actors become bankable stars when they're repeatedly passed over for roles? Besides, when you put a famous woman like Johansson in this role, the implicit message is that transgender men are really women. Maybe it seems like hubris to take offense at having other people imitate us, said Jennifer Finney Boylan in the New York Times. But we deserve to represent our own truth. When Leto and Eddie Redmayne were lauded for their courage for playing transgender women in Dallas Buyers Club and The Danish Girl, respectively, many trans women found those performances mannered, studied, and implausible. Of course, if you haven't walked in our shoes, you wouldn't notice the difference. Stroke, not what the GOP expected. President Trump's congressional enablers on the House Judiciary and Oversight Committees were planning last week to use Peter Stroke as the punching bag, said Rich Wilson in thedailybeast.com. Instead, he knocked them out. Stroke, of course, is the veteran FBI agent whose anti-Trump text messages to his mistress got him booted from special counsel Robert Mueller's team and caused a national furor when they were revealed. president himself has elevated Stroke to ringleader status in the supposed witch hunt against him. House Republicans hoped their melodramatic grilling of Stroke could damage Mueller's investigation. But Stroke was having none of it. He exhibited startling poise and passion as he insisted that he and his superiors at the FBI never let their personal political opinions affect their work, and denounced the hearing itself as just another victory notch in Putin's belt and another milestone in our enemy's campaign to tear America apart. He left Republicans flailing and humiliated and wondering where Stroke learned to hit back that hard. "This hearing was a farce, all right," said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com, "because Republicans let Stroke off easy. Yes, they berated him for his text and shamed him for cheating on his wife, but on the question of whether he spared Hillary Clinton from prosecution or ginned up the Russia probe for political purposes, Stroke's inquisitors let him cite FBI protocol and duck direct questions. Stroke even got away with claiming that the "we" in his infamous "we'll stop him" text referred to American voters, not the FBI, said Daniel Flynn in Spectator.org. That claim should have come with a laugh track. "Let's all recall how the FBI actually interfered in the 2016 election," said Paul Waldman in the WashingtonPost.com. Then Director James Comey's last-minute public announcement that he was reopening the Clinton probe likely threw the election to Trump. Yet here Congress is, 2 years later, looking for proof of an imaginary FBI plot to stop Trump. As Stroke himself noted, he could have ended Trump's campaign with one phone call to a reporter, said Michael Cohen in BostonGlobe.com. He, Comey, and the FBI knew Russia was making unusual overtures to Trump aides, hacking Democrats, and trying to get Trump elected. And on that note, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.